I'm David Mazenbring, and this is a session called Feasting Upon African Spirituality. And I'm looking forward to it because, unlike the kind of session I did last night when we looked at a film on Namibia, this is a more upbeat, more positive session. This is when we get to really appreciate the gifts of Africa and especially of African spirituality. So that's a positive kind of thing that I look forward to, as opposed to some of the more negative political things that we were looking at last night. What I propose to do is to run through several themes of African spirituality, and I'm purposely calling it African spirituality here rather than African Christianity, because all of these things show up in African Christianity, but they're part of African culture, and in many ways they're carryovers from African culture into African Christianity. And they would be true for all the African people, not only for African Christians. So I'll refer to it as African spirituality rather than African Christianity. The first thing I want to, and let me say also that I hope you will, you're going to get awful uncomfortable there, George. Why don't you take these chairs here?
Oh, that's okay.
You sure?
We'll curl up.
All right. Let me say that I hope you will take free opportunity to interrupt me as we go through this session with your questions. I hope that we will have some discussion about these issues as we go through them rather than just a straight lecture from me. But if I start getting excited and talking real fast, you will have to interrupt me to get your questions in. Don't politely sit and wait for me to take a break and then raise your hand in a gentle or a meek fashion. You'll never get your question in. Please be bold and interrupt me when you have something you want to contribute or another question you want to bring up. Just briefly, as an overview, the categories I want to look at are time, language, music, healing, sense of community, worship life, and family life. I thought we'd start with time because this is an area that has caused Westerners a lot of problem, and it's a good example of how sometimes we tend to write off Africa before we really come to understand it. For example, it's common to hear Westerners who are in Africa talk about the African sense of time. And that's really, we usually do that in kind of an insulting way. For example, if people show up to a meeting a half an hour late, we might say, well, they're operating on African time. And it just drives Westerners crazy that we are forever experiencing what we consider to be a lack of punctuality, the fact that Africans don't seem tuned into clocks the way that we Westerners are or think that they should be. There's some more chairs back here, Phil. So that's that issue of time, the African sense of time, is problematic for us Westerners. And if we approach Africa on our own terms, which are very much oriented towards these little mechanical instruments that we wear on our wrists, if we approach Africa in those terms, we're going to be disappointed and frustrated. And we may tend to look down on Africa as not being faithful to standards that we think are important. However, when viewed from an African perspective, what we would see as a liability might actually be considered as a strength. For example, if you were Africans and you were visiting another town, staying in a city with some friends, and let's say you had an appointment first thing the next morning, and you came into town that evening and you stayed with your friends that night, and you knew you had an appointment in town the next morning. According to our way of thinking, you would set a time for that appointment. You might say that, you know, your appointment is at 8 o'clock or is at 8:30. I think it's fair to say that in an African household, you would, your first obligation would be to your host and your hostess. Your sense of time is governed by a sense of human relationships. And your priority relationship will be with the people that you're with at the moment, the ones you're staying with. So you don't know what time they're going to serve breakfast to you. So rather than rush off in the morning in order to get into town by 8 o'clock and to meet your appointment strictly on time at 8 o'clock, you would say to that appointment, I'll be there first thing after breakfast. And then you would, at the home where you were staying, you would get up and you would become part of their cycle of time. you would enter into the time governed by the people with whom you stay. And when that period in the morning of getting up and washing and having breakfast, when you had been served with this hospitality and it ran its full course, then it would be natural for you to move on into town. So there's a sense in which your relations with other people always govern your sense of time. And it's not so much that you are governed by what the instrument on your wrist says to you about what point in the day you are at. It's rather that relations have a cycle to them. And the people that you meet deserve a certain amount of your time if you know them. It's unthinkable in African terms that you would pass by each other on a street and just say hello and keep on going. Now, when you meet someone that you're close to in Africa or family, you would stop and you would have a certain cycle of relationship that you would go through. And that is your primary time loyalty. Your loyalty of time is to that cycle and those relations more than it is to some piece of technology that we Westerners are fond of committing ourselves to, you know, the clock. So I start there as an example that sometimes the standards or the values that we bring to Africa might actually, if we hang on to them, might get in the way of our ability to meet the African people and to appreciate them on their own terms. I think that the sense of time which Africans have is a real gift of their spirituality. And they helped me loosen up my commitment to the chronos, the clock, in a way that I have come to appreciate. It certainly helped me relax a little bit. And it also made me less tense about expecting other people to keep time commitments with me, even though I still do get frustrated with my wife sometimes, who operates not according to Western standards of time. Language is another example how of a sense of African spirituality that gets in, that has been a problem for Westerners. The first missionaries who went to Africa learned languages, but after they learned languages and wrote them down, the succeeding waves of missionaries often often neglected learning the language as a big priority. And I think that has I think that's too bad, because Africans come out of an oral tradition. Our own tradition is a literate tradition. We write things down. Our history is a record of written things. Whereas Africa operates with an oral tradition which passes on the stories of history through oral. It's an oral passage. A father tells stories about his grandfather to his children, and the children pass those stories on to their children. Now, to a Westerner, this is a highly unreliable sense of history. We believe that the only valid history of what happened 300 years ago is when we can find out something that's been written down about that. Or today, increasingly, we buy into what archaeologists tell us as well. But we're very committed to a literate tradition, whereas Africans have an oral tradition. And unless we learn their language and develop a feel for that, we may risk not really gaining the gifts of the spirituality that comes to us through their language. And it is a rich spirituality. Historians are starting to tell us that there's a sense in which the oral tradition is highly faithful as a method of telling history. Even more faithful, they say, than the written tradition. Let's take things that were written down in the Middle Ages in Europe 1,000 years ago, or the early ages of Europe 1,000 years ago. I'm not sure how trustworthy it is to accept that literate form of history, because the way people use their language always changes. And if we accept the same words today as they were written 1,000 years ago, we may put a different meaning on a word today than it was intended to have 1,000 years ago. The definitions that we give to terminology are always in a state of flux. And so there's a sense in which we Westerners run into problems. We find this in interpretation of the Bible. sometimes, where certain terms are used in the Bible, or certain ways of telling a story are used in the Bible, that if we interpret them literally today, they don't mean at all what they meant when they were first written down. And so our sense of history can be a limited one, whereas the African methods of telling stories, of passing things on orally, and always updating the story to make sure that it says, it uses language, modern language, to communicate what happened yesterday. And there's a sense in which that version of history has proven to be very reliable, far more reliable than we initially thought. So the oral tradition, with its sense of history, is a gift of African spirituality. It also shows up in preaching. Some of you have had experience of Africa, and you know that Africans make great preachers. They make great speakers in general. This emphasis on the oral tradition involves a strong capacity for the gift of standing up in a group and speaking. And whereas in our own culture, many of us are nervous about that, Africans will do it at the drop of a hat. And they're very good at it. They're great extemporaneous speakers. And they make for great preachers. So one dimension of African spirituality, which is a gift to us, I think, is preaching. And we see that in our own black community in this country, where there's some great public speaking and great preaching that goes on in some of the storefront black Baptist churches in my neighborhood in Seattle or in cities across this country. Probably one of the richest examples of African language and the spirit that comes to us through African language are Proverbs. Now, we use Proverbs in our own society as well, but it's said that Africans have a highly developed sense of how they use Proverbs, and that, in fact, the whole traditional educational system of Africa, or not all of it, but much of it, was based on Proverbs. For example, I'll teach you a Xhosa proverb. The language that I learned to speak is Xhosa. It's a click language, and a very beautiful, poetic language. The adverbs or adjectives always qualify, of course they do that in English too, adverbs qualify verbs, or adjectives qualify nouns. But in Xhosa, and in fact in much of African language, they not only mean something to each other, but they have a kind of poetic symmetry to them. For example, the word for nice in Xhosa is Nandi. Now the word for food is Kucha. And the word for sun is langa. Now, this word nice changes depending on whether it's talking about nice food or nice sun. And the change that the word makes is designed to make the phrase nice food or nice sun sound more poetic. So, for example, if you're talking about nice food, you would say Ukucha kumnandi. You would put a KU in front of the mnad because you find a KU at the beginning of the noun here. The food is nice, it's ukucha kumnandi. If you wanted to say the sun is nice, there's no KU in the word for sun, langa. So you would change it. You would change mnandi to an LI. Ilanga limnandi. Ukucha kumnandi, ilanga limnandi. Both of those phrases have a kind of poetic symmetry to them, which is beautiful, and which sounds nice. And it would make sense that a tradition which has such a heavy emphasis on the oral tradition, an oral tradition, would develop a language which sounds nice. And that's a gift of African spirituality, I think. All right, now to go on to the proverb. In the Xhosa language, there is a proverb that I'll teach you now, which has parallels in many other African languages. Umtu ngumtu. Ngabantu. And as an example of how this would be used in an educational manner among African people, a rural Xhosa mother might say to her children, in feeding her children, she would give one bowl of food with one spoon in it to the oldest of, say, five children. And she would expect those children to share that one bowl of food without fighting about it. I had three younger brothers and one younger sister, and if my mother had given me one bowl of food with one spoon in it, I fear for the welfare of my siblings. I'm not so sure that they would have grown up to be as healthy as they are. But in Africa, as a result of an educational system which relies on a proverb like this one, it works. Because as the mother gives that bowl of food to her children, she says, Omtu gumtu ngabantu. It's the same word three times. There you see it once, Omtu gumtu. Just puts an ng on front of Omtu, so it's the same word. And abantu is the plural form of Omtu. Person, person, people. A person is a person because of other people. It's your relationships with other people that make you human. And if you, oldest child, can't share this food in a fair manner with your brothers and sisters, then you're less than human. You're less than what God has called you to be. Contrast that with the Western definition of humanity that inherits the Cartesian principle of I think, therefore I am. Individuality. Yeah? It's a very different notion than what comes through in this kind of an African proverb. I'm not saying that one is better than the other, but I think both of them have strengths, and we would do well to look at African proverbs as a way of understanding how some African spirituality is communicated to children. Another example of an African proverb is one which translates loosely like this. The spot of a cow shows more clearly in the calf. Now, if you think about it for a minute, you'll know that what they're saying is something that might only be a slight blemish in the parent can turn out to be a very obvious fault in the child. And there are thousands of proverbs. It would be fun sometime, especially with people that have far more African experience than I in the village. It'd be fun to put some Africa people together, so I mean, do a whole session just on African proverbs. We would, I'm sure, learn much about the spirituality of that continent if we did that. You're not jumping in with many questions yet. I hope you will take advantage of the opportunity to do that as we go through the evening.
You said something about the language. What was it?
The language which I learned is Xhosa. Yeah. If you listen real carefully, you can hear the X makes a sound. Xhosa. Ikleshu. Kundu. Kholesu.
What do they call that?
Xhosa. X-H-O-S-A.
Is there a name for that?
That's the language spoken by the Xhosa people. And they call it the Xhosa language. It's a click language. Miriam Makeba had a song out in the 60s called the Click Song, which was popular in the United States and which used those clicks. It's
How
a very beautiful...
People would that, when you say that, is it like a dialect or is it a...
It's
a language. How many people would be involved with that particular language? Because there are many.
Yeah, I wouldn't have numbers, but it is a language which has many different dialects within it that is spoken by a group of people in South Africa. It's one of maybe 10 major languages spoken in South Africa, and those languages would fall into two language families. Xhosa is a member of the Bantu language family, and those. Or Nguni, it's also called the Nguni language family. And Zulu is very closely related to Xhosa. So is Ndebele, which is spoken in Zimbabwe. Or, Shona isn't really very closely related, but Swazi.
Can they understand each other?
Yes, a person
like
speaking...
Scandinavian languages.
Yeah, a person speaking Zulu would be able to more or less understand a person speaking Xhosa.
What language is their Bible written in?
Scriptures have been translated into many African languages, and the Xhosa people have Xhosa scriptures.
When you're talking about these languages, is this mostly South Africa, or is it a universal thing to the whole
Africa? No, I think it is universal to say that anywhere on the continent of Africa, the African people have a strong reliance on oral tradition. They depend on the spoken word to communicate rather than the written word. And for the most part, Africans did not write their language down until the missionaries came, a fact which caused great problems because of the ethnic differences of the missionaries. For example, the two main language families in South Africa are the Nguni family and the Sesotho family. And although these are completely different languages and you cannot understand each other if two people are speaking them, there are some words which they share. For example, the word for you is the sound wena. And it's the same in Sesotho as it is in Xhosa. The two languages are completely different, but they use the same verbal, the same oral sound, wena, to mean you, Y-O-U, the word Y-O-U. Now what happens when an English missionary comes to the and works among the Xhosa people, as happened, and writes down that word? They write W-E-N-A, wena. But then among the Sesotho people, it was French missionaries who wrote down that language. And the French, of course, would not spell the sound wena, W-E-N-A. They spell it O-U-N-E or N-A. I don't speak French, something like that. So what was the same sound in two different languages has now become two completely different words when it's written down by one by the British and the other by the French. Kind of curious how our coming and writing the languages down actually created some barriers. I mean, it's not something I want to get down on us about, but it happened. And for the most part, the languages of Africa were first written down by missionaries who came and learned those languages and studied them. But throughout the languages of Africa, you will find people using proverbs. And often the same proverbs show up in different languages. Different, you know, of course they have different words. You wouldn't use this phrase in the Sesotho language like this, but you would have a phrase which would communicate the same idea, that a person is human because of their relationships with other people. A person is a person because of other people. Music is another rich example of African spirituality, and we could never talk about the spirit of Africa without mentioning at least music. One of the interesting things about music is it's in Africa it's a group phenomenon. Steve Biko, the black leader who was killed by South African police in 1977, writes about music, and I'd just like to quote a couple of paragraphs here if I could. It said, "Nothing dramatizes the eagerness of the African to communicate with each other more than their love for song and rhythm. Music in the African culture features in all emotional states. When we go to work, we share the burdens and pleasures of the work we are doing through music. This particular facet, strangely enough, has filtered through to the present day. Tourists always watch with amazement the synchrony of music and action as Africans working at a roadside use their picks and shovels with well-timed precision to the accompaniment of a background song." This would be true if you saw a group of Africans working, digging along a roadside, you'd find them all bringing their picks down at the same time, kind of in rhythm with the song that they were chanting. "Girls and boys never played any games without using music and rhythm as its basis. Battle songs were a feature of the long march to war in the olden days. In other words, with Africans, music and rhythm were not luxuries, but part and parcel of our way of communication. Any suffering we experienced was made much more real by song and rhythm. There is no doubt that the so-called Negro spirituals, sung by black slaves in the United States as they toiled under oppression, were indicative of their African heritage." Now he makes an interesting point here. "The major thing to note about our songs is that they were never songs for individuals. All African songs are group songs. Though they have many words, this is not the most important thing about them. Tunes were adapted to suit the occasion and had the wonderful effect of making everybody read the same things from the common experience. In war, the songs reassured those who were scared, highlighted the determination of the regiment to win a particular encounter, and are made much more urgent to the need to settle the score. In suffering, as in the case of the black slaves, they derived sustenance out of a feeling of togetherness. At work, the binding rhythm makes everybody brush off the burden, and hence Africans can continue for hours on end because of this added in energy." And then he goes on to talk at more length about the whole group orientation of the African people. and having made the point that music is only one example of how Africans are very group-oriented. This proverb is another example of that. I really believe that just as Westerners, through our emphasis on individualism, have been able to highly develop technology and the scientific method by isolating out things and focusing on their individual elements and the relationships of that. Just like our strength is technology, the strength of Africa is in the field of interpersonal relationships. It's group relations where Africans are so advanced. I believe that every culture in the world has areas in which it's advanced and other areas where it is not as advanced. And that our culture is clearly advanced on the side of technology, but I think Africans are more advanced than we are in this field of human relationships. And music is only one place where that shows up. The fact that their music is always group music, group-oriented, and that it's unthinkable in the African tradition that you would go to a concert and listen to someone sing. In Africa, music is a community experience, and where one person does music, they are inviting the whole community to be musical, and you do music in concert with each other. It leads to some very vibrant worship forms. At the Vespers later tonight, we're gonna you're gonna get exposed to a little bit of the vibrancy of African worship. I talked about it in the session on Monday night when I was talking about the African independent churches and the chanting which they do, and the dancing that they do. All of this makes for some very exciting worship. No getting bored in the African independent churches. And I think this is a gift of African spirituality that we would do well to gain from. And I hope, I can't wait for 8 o'clock and the African music that we're gonna do. And I hope that some of you, it'll be strange to you at first, but I hope that as you get more and more used to it in the next few years, you will come to also get excited about it. Africans tell their history through music. They have a wonderful ability to spontaneously harmonize in their music. And something that we definitely will not be able to duplicate tonight is when Africans are doing a chant, one person will start the chant, and it's always very spontaneous. Larry Rasmussen tells a story about his experience in Tanzania, where on Christmas Day, right after the Christmas story had been read in church, a woman who had just given birth to a baby in the community a few days earlier just kind of stood up during the service and lifted up her baby and showed it to the people around. Broke into a song. And the people would kind of answer her with the same kind of a chant. And she would just extemporaneously make up praises of thanksgiving for the gift of this child. And the congregation would always sort of answer her in chant. And certain members of the congregation would automatically just start harmonizing with each other. That's the sort of thing that you sometimes hear at Holden. Where, you know, there are so many musically gifted people around here, it's not uncommon during a Vesper service to hear someone just break into a harmony in the course of it. But ordinarily, in our culture, we expect that that kind of harmonizing is something that gets rehearsed during a choir rehearsal. And we only listen to it when it's been well rehearsed by some individuals. It's a much more spontaneous thing and reflects, I think, the gifts of African people for music. Healing is certainly an element of African spirituality that we would have to give a lot of attention to. Now the question is whether there are hymns in the Lutheran Book of Worship which are inherited from Africa. I would say through the experience of Black American culture, yes. For example, the song Kumbaya, I believe that's in the LBW, isn't it? No? It's not.
Literally, you
sing that. Yeah. We know the song, but it's not in the LBW. Too bad. There are others, though. If you look in the back of the LBW, there are about six Negro spirituals which have made their way into the... We sang one at Eucharist on Sunday night, In Christ There Is No East or West. That's an African, that's a Negro spiritual. But I'm not familiar with any, does anyone know?
I think there's one or two that's come from East Africa.
All right.
I think Malilangay, which is a Maasai herd boy, speaking about his sheep, translated the Lamb of God. I think that one is in there. Must have used very good.
All right.
But Dr. Howard Olson, some of you may know him, he's a famous part of it. He's very much at the forefront in this type of thing. In fact, under his leadership at the Theological Seminary in Macomira, they produced an entire hymnal which has used the traditional African melodies, and two of them have put Christian words, and is an alternate hymn book in most of our congregations. So there's been a very definite movement there, you know, to accept the tribal songs, melodies, as a legitimate vehicle for the transmission of the message. And it's been exciting.
Yeah.
It's a movement. I don't know about the rest of Africa, but in Tanzania that has taken place. And it's become, you know, rather well known as one of the first in that area. But I happen to know about this one because it's a Maasai herdsboy's tribal song as he sings about his sheep when he's herding. And that's been picked up. And we use it in our services. The Swahili services now use it as theirs. And it translates Lamb of God. But it is a herdsboy's normal song as he sings to his sheep.
And of course, a very effective method of evangelizing, to take traditional music and give it Christian words. We'll use a songbook at Vespers tonight, which is all songs from Africa that the village has copies of. I said that healing is a big part of African spirituality. And African Christians take seriously the promises of the New Testament that healing is one of the gifts of our new life in Christ. And I think it's an area that they have much to offer us. I talked about it the other night. How many were there Monday night when I talked about the African independent churches? Not all of you, but a good number of you. So you know that faith healing is widely practiced in African Christianity and is an example of the spirit that exists there. To some extent, it's inherited from traditional African thinking. For example, in traditional African culture, there is a sympathetic relationship between therapist and patient. As I said on Monday night, where the therapist actually is expected to know what the physical illness is when the patient comes. You know, in a Western setting, Western doctor, you go into the doctor's office and the doctor says, well, what's wrong? And you tell the doctor you're having a stomachache. In an African setting, you come in and the doctor tells you that you have a stomachache and that's why you've come. You can imagine what sort of problems the missionary doctors ran into when they went to Africa, because they would invite a patient into their office and say, well, now what kind of problems are you having? And the patient would stand up and walk out and say, this guy doesn't know his business. He's supposed to tell me what's wrong. Now, I can't explain how this happens, but I have seen it happen. The old lady that I talked about on Monday night, who's a very prominent faith healer in the African independent churches, I have seen her, I've seen situations where she has predicted to me, and this is a woman that I call my mother, and she calls me her son, and we don't, there's a high degree of integrity in our relationship. We're very close, and she's not staging these things for my benefit. She said to me one time, I'm feeling really badly. And I said, well, what's wrong? Didn't you sleep well last night or something? And she said, no, I slept fine. And then she said, I think we're going to have visitors. And I didn't really understand what that meant. And sure enough, an hour later, a woman showed up from another town about 100 miles away who had heard about the healing gifts of this old lady and had come to see the old lady because she was having a lot of problems. And the old lady took her and they sat on the stoop for a while and they talked, and the patient explained what her problems were, and then the old lady prayed for her and asked me to come over, and we laid hands on her and prayed for her, and then she went on her way. And about an hour and a half later, the old lady said to me, well, I'm feeling much better now. And I still hadn't put the two things together, so I said, oh, did you take a nap? Because I was still thinking that it was because she hadn't slept well the night before or something. And she laughed at me and she said, "No, don't you remember? I told you we were going to get visitors. I was sick because I was expecting someone else who was sick. And she said, "It always happens to me that when I get a new patient, I experience the illness of that patient in myself. And that helps me know how to minister to that person." Now that's just, it blows my mind, you know, and we Westerners cannot understand it. But I've seen it happen, and increasingly there is talk, even in the field of medicine, but certainly in the field of psychiatry, that this is a phenomenon which goes on in other parts of the world, and is certainly part of their spirituality that we may not know, but which I think we could trust African Christians to teach us a lot about. I might add here that in that kind of a situation, you can bet one doesn't choose to become a doctor. You, as in our own society, you cannot decide for yourself to be a healer and then go and study Western medicine. I mean, you can do that in Africa, but you won't become a traditional type African healer. Those healers are chosen by God. And whether it's in the traditional African religion or in African Christianity, these healers are people who are sick for a long period of time, and finally a healer says to them, "I think God is calling you to be a healer, and you will never get well until you take up this work." So one almost has to be called to a ministry of healing, just as one is called to other ministries, rather than choosing it for yourself. Another interesting thing about the spirituality of healing in Africa is what it says about relationships again. Healing or health, sickness, is always viewed as a family problem. You would never go and see a doctor on your own. I mean, you might go see a Western doctor that way, but you wouldn't go see a traditional healer or a Christian healer on your own. Healing is viewed as a family problem, and you would be expected to come with your whole family, or at least representatives of your whole family, because there's such a holistic approach taken to health. None of this business of saying spiritual problems, you consult a pastor, and psychological problems, you see a psychiatrist, and physical problems, you see a doctor. A very strong, holistic approach taken to healing in Africa, and one which takes seriously the relations of your family and your whole community. And you, in fact, might be found to be experiencing sickness, which is really the result of some bad community relations or some bad family relations. Now this sort of leads us into family life, and I'm sure many of you know that there is a very strong respect for older age in Africa. In fact, in many third world cultures, there's a profound respect given to people based on their seniority. And you see this in the way small children relate to older children, or children to parents, but especially in relation to the most senior members of the community. And no matter how off base their advice might be, they will always be given a very serious listening, and they will be afforded great respect. Now, I don't think that there's very many things you can do in African society that are a more serious breach of etiquette than to show disrespect to an elder, especially a senior member of the community. I live, my wife and I live in Seattle with her grandfather's sister, who is 101 years old. And when I tell Africans about this woman who we live with, who's 101 years old, they're just overwhelmed at the power that they, and the respect that they have for someone of that age. And they say there's much to be gained from listening to those who have more experience of life than ourselves. And I think that there is that respect for older people is an element of African spirituality from that we would we have much to learn from, especially when we look at how older people are dumped and pushed out of sight in our own society. Older people are given a free rein in the African community. It's expected that they are the emissaries who bring news from one family to another. You know, the older people have the time to wander around and visit different homes. And they carry the news of the community around that way, and they are always welcomed wherever they go because of the, their respect. Another point, you know, along the lines of family life is the strong bond that people feel through a blood connection. When two Africans meet for the first time, inevitably they will begin to share with each other their lineage. And they do this in an effort to discover whether or not they might be second or third or fourth cousins in some way. It's inevitably the first thing two people will do when they meet is they'll start tracing their ancestry and trying to establish whether or not they might in some way be related. And Africans are very conscious of their lineage. It's becoming less the case today, but traditionally an African would be able to cite back their ancestors up to maybe seven generations. It goes without saying that this respect for blood linkage involves a great deal of common support for each other, that anyone who has a blood relationship with me is always my responsibility. If they're in some kind of material hard place, you know, if they're struggling materially, then of course I will take them into my home. It's very common that a man, parents who have too many children, more children than they can support, might give some of those children to an uncle or a brother or a sister. And that person will take those children in and raise them as though they were they were my own. Or that you refer to my mother as anyone who is an aunt. Not only my, what we would call my mother, but my aunt would also be called my mother because she is the sister of my mother. And so forth and so on. Worship life, we said something about that. Yeah, Phil.
On the family life, would that also refer to, would cousins be called brothers and sisters?
Yes, definitely. And it's very confusing to Westerners because you have an African friend who introduces you to three or four people who he calls his mother. Or you start meeting all these people that he calls his brother and you wonder how many kids there are in the family and until you realize that the term is used broadly.
You meet children too on the street or are way out in where the Africans live, they'll come up, I know I had to call me mother.
Yeah.
And you know, you just, odd.
Uh-huh. Well, and they might do that out of respect for your age too.
Yeah, everyone is a mother.
I think another interesting part about the interpersonal relationships within the families, most of them are hooked together in terms of clans, which will identify a larger group. But in naming, you are known by the name of your child, and your children are known by the name of the father. So our oldest son is my son, and I am known as the father of Stefano, not as Reverend David Simonson. My wife is not known as Mrs. Simonson, but she is known as the mother of Naomi. So there's that relationship there, which, you know, in a society like the States, I should think not too many of us would like to be recognized by what our children's name or what reputation they might have. It might be difficult. But in these interrelationships, parents are known by the names of their children, and the children are known by the names of their parents. So you have the Prime Minister of Tanzania now, who's Edward Ole Sekwene. Some Norwegians get happy because they think there's a bit of Norwegian influence. Ole happens to be the Maasai name of the male derivative for the son of. His father's name is Sekwene. But his son will be named Marco Ole Edward. So that he's known by his immediate father. So the relationship there, which shows it. Closeness of relationship, even
with their families. Yeah, and that's beautiful because it's a reminder of that system of naming is a reminder to people that they represent a family in their community, and I know every time that I am called the son of Victor that my actions reflect on my parents. And my parents know, I mean, they would know in the African situation, that my actions reflect on who they are. One more thing I want to say about this sense of community, which is so strong in Africa, and I, in some ways, have saved the best for last. Throughout Africa, missionaries and anthropologists and people who have really gotten to know Africans well, to a person, tend to show just overwhelming respect for the African capacity for forgiveness. And given the role that forgiveness plays in our own Christian religion, this is an area where we have much to learn from Africans. And it's just one of those areas where the gift of Africa is so outstandingly apparent. I'll tell you a story. I knew a man in South Africa named Beyers Naudé, very outspoken critic of the South African government, and a man who more than any other white that I met in South Africa really knows the African people and has a great deal of respect for them and has done a lot of work with them, has had a lot of contact with them. And over dinner one night, he told me a story about how there were some, I think these were two independent church leaders. He's done a lot of work with the African independent churches. And these were two people who had a dispute with each other. And he talks about bringing them into his office and trying to mediate in this dispute, and how bitter the argument between these two individuals came. And this stretched out over many months and even years. And he said every time he'd bring them together, they would just fight tooth and nail. And he actually feared that physical violence was going to break out right there in his office because of the extreme bitterness shown between these two people who were having this argument. And he says how one day, one of the parties, he brought the parties together again, and this time one of the parties in this argument had apparently done some thinking about the situation and had listened to the charges of the other party and had decided that maybe he was in the wrong. And he actually apologized. He kind of, right when the meeting, when they first got together, he said, I have something I want to say. And he said, I've thought about what my brother here has said to me, and I think the time has come that I need to apologize. I think that I was wrong in this argument, and that I'm sorry for that, and I acknowledge the error of my ways. And Naudé talks about how he is just how shocked he was at the ability of those two people. Once the party in error acknowledged the error of his ways, the ability of these two people to go on into the future with no trace of that problem. How they were able to actually forget something that was the source of tremendous bitterness between them. Now, in Western culture, we are familiar with the concept of forgiveness. I know that when my brother, who I haven't always gotten along with real well, he wrongs me, that I need to forgive him, but I never forget it. And Africans have an ability to forget that after there has been an admission of guilt. In this book by Kenneth Kaunda, which I recommend to all of you for a number of reasons, Kenneth Kaunda is the president of Zambia. He came to power in Zambia through a movement of nonviolence. And in this book called The Riddle of Violence, which is published by Harper and Row, he talks about how on the basis of his Christian pacifist principles, he felt obligated to support the freedom fighters in Zimbabwe. It's a very challenging book on the whole issue of violence. And he takes everybody to task. He argues with the people who say violence is always wrong. He argues with the people who say we have to take up arms to win our independence. He argues with everybody from a very personally painful position. But in the last couple of pages of the book, he has a postscript on forgiveness that I'd like to read to you here. He says, I have seen the bodies of innocent refugees in Zambia blown to bits by Rhodesian bombers. And my soul has been so tormented by my raging mind and my angry heart that had I not been able to forgive my enemies because Christ has forgiven me, I should have become deranged with fury. And what is worse, any new relationship with the Rhodesian whites who did these things would have been utterly impossible had I not been able to forgive them. And that must be a double tragedy for the state of my soul and for the relations between Zambia and Zimbabwe. Africa cannot afford the luxury of such feuds. It is by the power of forgiveness that we are freed from the burden of past guilt so that we can act boldly in the present. Let me read that sentence again. It is by the power of forgiveness that we are freed from the burden of past guilt so that we can act boldly in the present. And then he goes on to say, I think of some of the whites in Zambia who were amongst my bitterest enemies during the freedom struggle. They have since concluded that they were mistaken, which makes me very happy. But they keep coming back and harping on those old days, wringing their hands and repeatedly expressing regret. I try to say to them that they just don't understand what forgiveness means. They have been offered forgiveness, but they refuse to accept it. All that matters now is that they should stand shoulder to shoulder with us in building up the nation. This is surely what forgiveness is about, the freedom to stop going back to our past mistakes and feeling the pain of them again. I think that's very profound. We can never forget because we are always focused on the injustice that someone did to us. Africans, because of their superior understanding of human community and how human community works, realize that so long as I admit my guilt to you, you should be big enough to know that the only way we can go on into the future is if we all forget this incident. And forgiveness is another, and maybe in many ways the most important area that we have to learn from Africans. Because there are many things that we need to be forgiven for, not the least of which is the current situation in Southern Africa today. And repeatedly, I've worked with groups in this country who say, But what's going to happen if blacks come to power? Aren't the whites going to really experience a lot of backlash? And ultimately, when it comes right down to it, whites in Southern Africa, even if they're willing to admit that blacks have got a lousy deal, what still grips them is a fear, which comes out of their own guilty conscience, that if blacks came to power, whites would just experience tremendous hatred and retribution. And I think there's a sense in which this fear is the product of not knowing the African people. That if we knew them better, we would know they have the capacity, once we admit the error of our ways, to put the past behind us and to go on together in the future, because they know they need good relations with us to work in the future. And promise has certainly been borne out in Zimbabwe, where after 17 years of a civil war, blacks came to power, and the first thing that they did was to say to the whites, we need you, we want you to stay in the country. And let's forget the past and go forward in the future. And that's happening in a way that whites have really been surprised by. So I conclude there as an example that Africa has much more to offer us than we can imagine, and that we should be open to that. I recommend it. We could take maybe one question, two questions, if...
I was just going to make a comment.
Please.
I used to work on an Indian reservation in Idaho, and a lot of what you said about that African spirituality, I think, is also very much present in the Native American spirituality and their oral tradition, their sense of time, their emphasis on healing, community, that sort of thing.
Family?
At least in the group or the tribe that I worked with.
Thank you, because I think a lot of this is true of third world peoples everywhere, and just as white South Africans don't know blacks and fear them, I think there's much of the same true for us in relation to Native Americans. And I was at a weekend last winter called One in the Spirit, which is put together here in the Northwest, to give some Christians an opportunity to meet with Native Americans. And it's I was humbled at the depth of spirituality present alongside of us here that I have just been completely isolated from all my life. Phil?
The third world African, maybe this is not a fair question, but I see a tendency of many third world peoples who want to become like us because they think that we are civilized and have the good life. Is there an awareness of these tremendous gifts that in many ways we should probably call them the first world?
Uh-huh.
Because they are in a much better situation in terms of community and relationships. And they may not have the physical things and all that, but is there an awareness that these are tremendous gifts? And does that bring a sense of, self-worth and self-confidence, and without a desire to become like we are? Right?
Well, it's a mixed bag. And there are many tragic stories about the loss of respect for tradition in Africa, particularly in the course of urbanization and the influx of materialism in Africa. There are a lot of sad stories of Africans losing respect for their traditions and becoming very materialistic. There are also some very encouraging stories of regaining a sense of respect for tradition. I'm talking about the cities now. I think in the rural areas, the respect for traditions tends to continue very strongly. Steve Biko, what he was all about was recovering a respect for African tradition. His whole theory of black consciousness was, how do we regain a renewed respect for who we're about? And that's precisely what made him so dangerous to the white community and why he was killed while being held in a white police cell. His movement, I know, will outlive him. But he's the kind of person who comes along once in a generation. And he was killed at the age of 30. I recommend this book to discover the hope that is happening in Africa. It's called I Write What I Like by Steve Biko. It's published by Harper & Row. And there are still a few copies in print, not many. I think last time I checked with them, there were about 143 copies left. So order it quick. $8.95, good price for a hardback. And he's got a whole variety of essays in here on African culture, the church, U.S. foreign policy, black consciousness, the role of white liberals, and then a memoir at the end of the book, which is maybe where you should start if you buy it, called Martyr of Hope, about why some of us felt that he was a good example of a Christian martyr. And in that memoir, you get a sense of who he was, and then his essays will make more sense to you.